time to get from North Carolina to LA, even with advanced airplane travel. But back in the earliest days of airplane travel, there was a plane flying from the East Coast to LA. And it had been in the air for a long time, and it had descended into a heavy fog as it flew over the Rocky Mountains. It was in this heavy fog for what seemed like a very long time. And finally, the pilot came over the loudspeaker, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have good news and bad news. First, the bad news, we're lost. Now the good news, we're 2 hours ahead of schedule." I want to suggest that's not a bad description of the plight of higher education in contemporary America, or in many ways the broader culture, or indeed the world. In many ways, we're lost. We don't have a very clear sense of direction. For many people, the future isn't what it used to be. There's a sense of purposelessness, of anxiety, of unsettledness, of bewilderment, and yet the pace of things happening is faster than ever before. Used to be called keeping up with the Joneses, but I'm a Jones and even I can't keep up. It is bewildering just how fast everything is changing. It was, you know, astonishing for my kids to discover that when I became dean of Duke Divinity School in 1997, my wife suggested I should get a cell phone. And I said, "I don't really think that's necessary." That was just 20 years ago. I mean, that's how much things are changing. And you begin to think, Greg mentioned globalization, technology, financialization, the tendency now increasingly to measure everything by short-term profit and loss statements, by maximizing shareholder value in the short term, by gross national product. All of these forces are impinging in powerful ways. And then you add in, we'll come back to it, but machine learning and artificial intelligence as part of that technological change, and the world just feels bewildering. It doesn't feel like it used to be. And that's unsettling, even as we're not sure where we're heading. Now, we could spend some time just talking about that lost sense of purpose. What Charles Taylor talks about is a secular age, that time that at the beginning of modernity, there weren't really atheists, because even the non-believers were more likely deists. They assumed there was a God. It was just a question of whether God was engaged with the world and how. So that even the unbelievers were kind of believers, or at least theists, to where Taylor says at the end of modernity, even the believers live and act as if there's no God. A diagnosis that I fear afflicts my own life far too often. You know, Dorothy Day's line that she wanted to live her life in a way that wouldn't make sense if God doesn't exist. My life makes way too much sense most days, regardless of whether there is a God or if that God's active in the world or in our lives. So that sense of the loss of a sense of purpose and a telos, but it's a huge challenge. I want to take just a few moments and take us on a journey to what is probably your favorite book of the Bible. So I apologize if you've been studying it so carefully and spending time in devotions and teaching and preaching on it regularly. It's the book of Numbers. Now, in a group like this that actually is interested in economics, you may actually not have quite the PTSD kind of reaction to a book that's called Numbers, but for most ordinary believers, they see that and it just evokes that memory of whenever it was in your life you decided math was no longer for me. But in the Jewish tradition, that book has often been called In the Wilderness. And if that was the way it appeared in the Bible, it really would be the central text for our devotions. Now, you know that the title Numbers comes from the two censuses that are taken, but the dominant reality of the Israelites' experience is being in the wilderness. I want to focus just very briefly on chapters 10 to 21. David Stubbs, in Holland, Michigan, at Western Seminary there, argues in his commentary on Numbers that there's a chiasm here. And it's really instructive about what the experience in the wilderness is. He says that at D and D prime, roughly chapter 10 and 21, you have the Israelites and they're just complaining. And they're complaining, but it's just whining like two-year-olds at the beginning of a long trip. Are we there yet? Just kind of generic whining, the kinds of stuff you can hear in lots of contexts in our culture these days. But it's just generic. It gets more serious when you get to C and C prime, when the complaints are now about bread and water. Because now it's about the stuff of life that gives sustenance to daily life. And so the complaints, they're getting serious. And then as you move in closer to the heart of the story, at B&B Prime, it's complaints about leadership. If only we had better leaders. You ever hear that in theological education? Have people in churches. If only we could find the pastor who would lead us out of the wilderness and everything would all be all right again. In B&B Prime, first it's Miriam and Aaron saying, how come Moses gets to be the leader? It's an interesting side note. The description is he's more humble. Anybody who's been reading Exodus, you know, humility in Moses doesn't actually kind of resonate real quickly in your mind, except unless you think, as Richard Briggs suggests, that what characterizes the narrator's description of Moses' humility is that humility comes out of intimacy with God. It's not the kind of passive aggressiveness we often call humility in the church. But it's that intimacy with God. It's being able to travel in the deep end of the pool when most of the noise in our contemporary religious life comes from the shallow end. But that's the distinction between Moses and Miriam and Aaron is leadership. And then you have the Korah's rebellion in chapters 15 and 16 where hundreds of people die. In a rebellion against the leadership. But then you get to the heart of the story. So you've got complaints about bread and water. Then you've got complaints about leadership. And you get to the heart of the story, which is the 12 spies. You know the story of the 12 spies. Moses sends out the 12 spies to spy out the promised land. They come back. They're the first Americans in the Bible because they have a majority report and a minority report. The majority say, oh, we can't deal with this. Yeah, there's a land flowing with milk and honey, but there are so many obstacles up ahead. They look like giants. We're like grasshoppers. There is no way we can get there. We had better go back to Egypt. Only two of the 12, Joshua and Caleb, say, we ought to trust that if God is leading us to the promised land, that we can follow that. Well, you know what the crowd says, right? Let's go back to Egypt. Egypt was suffering. Egypt was slavery. Egypt was oppression. But Egypt was familiar. My father, who was a pastor and a seminary educator, all his life said every church he ever was a part of had a Back to Egypt committee in it. Every seminary has a Back to Egypt committee in it. The truth of the matter is every one of us has a Back to Egypt part of our soul. That we see what God is calling us to in the future, and we say, but look at the obstacles, look at the challenges, look at globalization, look at technology, look at machine learning, look at the nature of work, look at the displacement of jobs, look at the challenges. Let's go back to Egypt. Aviva Zornberg, a Jewish writer, has a really extraordinary book on numbers called Bewilderments. And she says the real crisis, the real sin of the 12 spies is not just their nostalgia to go back to the past. She says it's a death wish because it's the death of the imagination. That's the deepest crisis. It's not leadership. It's not even complaining. It's not even bewilderment. It's when the wilderness defines you in a way that you lose imagination and a sense of purpose and a sense of direction. Now, much of what's been really good about the recovery of the theology of work conversations in the U.S. over many years that many of you have been leading have been to really try to hone in on that question of purpose for lay people's vocation in the world and how to understand work and vocation and honor that in powerful ways. And yet, if we're not doing that in terms of the nature and purpose of the church and of seminary education and of institutions more broadly, and unless we recover that telos of what it means to bear witness to the land flowing with milk and honey, in Christian terms, the reign of God, inaugurated in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, unless that animates all that we are and all that we do, we're going to give in to the bewilderment that actually leads to the death. Not just physically, but the death of the imagination. I want to suggest that once the Israelites get reoriented on that sense of purpose, they begin to practice traditioned innovation. We'll come back to unpack that. The Daughters of Zelophehad. It's one of the great stories. I made it all the way through seminary, through doctoral work, through teaching for 9 years. I was dean of Duke Divinity School when I went to a party at a gathering like this, and the name tags had name and institution, and there was an African-American woman who had her name, and right underneath it said, the Daughters of Zelophehad. I said, what's that? She said, well, you know the story in Numbers. And I said, yeah! And immediately turned to go find somebody else to talk to before I exposed my ignorance. But you know the story, the Daughters of Zelophehad dies. And the practices of the Israelites were that the land would go to another male. And the daughters go, hey, wait, Moses, what's up with this? This is unjust. We should be getting the land. Moses, remember that intimacy with God and that humility? He didn't say, that's just the way it is. He said, well, let me go talk to God about it. He goes and talks to God about it, and God says, you know, they got a point. And so the practice changes. Why? Because they're focused on the end. The end, in a Christian sense, is our beginning. It's where we have to take our bearings. And yet, when we don't do that, we get caught. One of the dangers of gathering people in theological education these days is it becomes a kind of navel-gazing, inside baseball kind of conversation that just begins to say, how bad's your financials? Because everybody's struggling. What's your enrollment looking like? What's your relationship to your denomination? How dysfunctional is your sponsoring denomination? Or if you're non-denominational, who is it that you're able to find partnerships with? And the conversation starts to close in. You begin to think, maybe we could go back to Egypt. You begin to long for some nostalgic past. My grandfather was a Methodist minister in Iowa when my wife and I went to meet with him, because we were both in seminary at the time, and we were trying to figure out ministry and all this, and he just said to us, he said, after he reminded us that itinerancy in the Methodist tradition wasn't something that he could probably help us navigate, because he grew up as a child of 12, one of 12 children, and they moved appointments every 12 out of 13 years in the horse and buggy days. So he said, if you're really worried about moving every now and again, I'm probably not the best source of solace for you. But he also said, I want you to remember the rest of your life, nothing accounts for a longing for the good old days quite so much as a bad memory. And a lot of the nostalgia in theological education has a lot more to do with a bad memory, and in particular a short memory, something I'm going to come back to in just a moment. But if we were here, I've spent several years in university leadership roles at Baylor and at Duke. One of the things that did was it got me out of theological education and looking at other professional schools. At Baylor, there are 12 professional schools, and what I discovered was every single one of those professional schools was asking similar questions to theological education. And every one of them was wrestling with globalization and technology and financialization in really complicated ways. Valparaiso University's law school, a fine law school in the upper Midwest, 5 years ago had 238 students. It had declined to a couple of dozen, and it's now closed. A law school. Business schools, MBA enrollments are declining rapidly. Medical education is going through huge crises and transitions, and there's a desire for new niche medical schools that are emerging. Social work, you name the school and it's got the challenges. So we need to zoom out a little bit to look at the broader forces in the world that are out there, some of which Greg was talking about. You're gonna be dealing with around economics and economic responsibility, technology. They're affecting higher education generally. There are particular angles that affect seminary education. But we've got to look at that and then also recognize that it's a shared predicament. It's not just one sector. It's not only the church. And actually, I'm going to suggest it's not even especially the church. That this is actually our time, if we can seize it. Now that's a big if, and so if you're taking a note, put the if in capital letters and underline it 5 or 6 times. Because I'm not at all confident that we collectively, or many of us in our individual settings, are really interested in trying to seize it. Because it requires a clarity about that end and purpose and where we're headed, and it requires a willingness to risk and to experiment and to build new bridges that, well, Machiavelli put it 500 years ago, men like new ideas only when they have long experience of them. This isn't just a faculty problem. Machiavelli thought it was a generic human problem. But this is the church's time. I think it's incredibly important for us to see it's not that we're the weak sister or the problematic sector. It's affecting everybody. And it's not only affecting higher education, it's affecting K-12, it's affecting investment banking and healthcare. And Niall Ferguson had a book 3 or 4 years ago called The Great Degeneration. The subtitle is How Institutions Decay and Economies Die. And all he was talking about was the law, economics, politics, and education. He didn't have anything to do with religion. The predicament is shared. And yet this is the time when the church and theological education ought to be leading and seizing the day. What do I mean by that? Well, it has to do with the way in which, if you're guided by a clear sense of purpose, you wouldn't believe how often when I'm in business school settings or talking to practicing business leaders, they want to talk about purpose. It's the new rage. But you know, they're talking about like the purpose of salty snacks, not the reign of God. When it comes to purpose, we ought to be hands down. And it's an inclusive purpose where then you can talk about the role that salty, maybe not salty snacks, but transportation plays in bearing witness to the reign of God, or education, or other kinds of vocations, entrepreneurship. But it's shaped by the end. Part of what that means for theological education is we need to be much better at understanding our own history. I used to like to tweet the dean of the law school that, for most of American history, lawyers were not educated in law schools. The best lawyers didn't even have a JD until relatively recently. Justo Gonzalez's Brief History of Theological Education is a reminder that God has seemed able to raise up pastors and to organize churches for most of the 2,000 years, diachronically, and if you include the entire world, for much of the world contemporaneously, without a Master of Divinity degree. Who'd have thunk it? And yet I ran a divinity school as a dean for 13 years on the presumption that that was like, not just the gold standard, it was the entry card. And you were a fraud if you didn't have one. We need a larger imagination, a longer imagination of what kind of education will prepare people for leadership in the 21st century. It is a leadership that practices traditioned innovation for institutions. Now, part of what we have to do is give up the bureaucratic metaphors that have defined how we think about organizations and institutions, particularly in American culture over the 20th century. We tend to think of them as inert, which is what leads you to the assumption that you can decide whether something needs to be changed or not. If it's just an object, like a motorcycle, you say, well, I like it kind of as it is. And you need a really long horizon to see it rust away. But our metaphors actually are mistaken when we think of them in mechanistic terms. We ought to be thinking about organizations in organic terms. John Gardner was one of the pioneers in 1962 with a little book that's still in print because it's just a gem of a book called Self-Renewal. He was criticizing the kind of sociological theories of the 1950s that gave rise to General Motors and that kind of hierarchical organization chart. And he said, we need to think of organizations organically, that they're constantly growing and decaying and needing to be pruned. I think Jesus said something about pruning. There's actually more organic metaphors than mechanistic ones that we could draw on if we actually knew how to tell our own story in Scripture well. But if you begin to think about those organic metaphors, then it's not a question of do we change, it's a question of what changes are we leaning into? How do we prune for the sake of future growth? How do we continue to draw from the past in the most creative ways that will lend ourselves into the future? You see, the frenetic pace that we're dealing with, being 2 hours ahead of schedule, and the issues of globalization and technology and financialization and the bad business models that we've been operating with in lots of different sectors for a very long time, have led to this sense of we gotta just make some stuff up. And much of what goes under the name of innovation is just making stuff up. That's not real innovation. That's like a middle school band concert, and nobody wants to go to that house, even the parents. Authentic innovation is like going to Preservation Hall in New Orleans. Because when you want to see beautiful music, it's rooted in a deep understanding of the past, of the repertoire and core music that you can always return to when you get a little haywire. And it's rooted in the formation of habits and skills that enable you to listen to those around you and thus create the kind of spirit of improvisation. If you want to know what tradition innovation looks like musically, just Google John Coltrane, My Favorite Things. He takes that song from The Sound of Music, and you're hearing it, and you're going, oh, I love that song. And then he takes you on a journey, and you're going, This ain't My Favorite Things anymore. And then he brings you back, and you go, oh, yes, it is. And then he takes you away again. There's that core and that creativity that's rooted in this connection. So I was worried about the John Cotter garbage about leading change. It was always about changing everything and just make stuff up. And I shouldn't say garbage. There's some good stuff in it. But we got so fascinated with change for change's sake. And just make everything up as if we throw out what's ever been in the past. It's kind of hard as Christians to say we're going to throw out the past unless we're willing to give up Scripture. There are people trying that. But doesn't have much of a future. So I started thinking about this, and Ron Heifetz was a Duke, and I was talking to him, and he said, well, you know, my approach to adaptive leadership, people have always thought was just focused on change. He said, the root of that idea actually came from evolutionary biology. And adaptation in evolutionary biology, only 1-3% changes. 97-99% of the organism needs to be preserved. We need to be paying more attention to what we're preserving as well as what we're changing. It was like a light bulb went on over my head, and I said, that's it. So I sat down with a friend of mine who teaches New Testament at Duke, who's a lot smarter than I am, Kevin Rowe. And we were having lunch, and I said, what comes to your mind if you hear the phrase tradition innovation? Because I just got that, those two words came together, and he said, the book of Acts. I thought, well, this is encouraging since he wrote a book on the book of Acts. And they said, well, actually, Luke and Acts. And I just kept my mouth shut for once, and he kept talking. I said, well, the four Gospels in Acts. He said, actually, you could describe tradition innovation as a biblical way of thinking, because only God does pure innovation. Only God creates out of nothing. The rest of us are always creating in response to various things that have gone before us. The key is we have to be able to retrieve the most life-giving parts of the past for the sake of the most dynamic and creative opportunities in the future. Sounds like good jazz comedy. You know Yaroslav Pelikan's famous distinction in his lecture on the vindication of tradition, that traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. Tradition is the living faith of the dead. We all have plenty of experiences in seminaries and in churches and in other settings of traditionalism, where people are just doing the same thing over and over again for no apparent reason. Nobody can give you any reason why. That's traditionalism. It needs to be kept in the past. We know the sinful, broken parts of the past, but we too often throw the baby out with the bathwater. Rather than recognize the living character of the tradition that makes our life possible, that enables us then to live into the future. But that traditioning process is shaped by our orientation toward the end. It's shaped toward the reign of God, and that's what enables us to discover what it is we most need to preserve. It's the criteria, the reference point, the touchstone that guides us so we know what we're preserving, so that then our improvisation is faithful and animated by the Holy Spirit. What do we say about the Holy Spirit? The Holy Spirit is making all things new. How? By conforming us to Christ, who is the one in whom creation came to be. It all holds together when we see it in the context of that larger story of God's creation, redemption, and promised consummation in the new age. Well, what does that look like? When you begin to think in terms of traditioned innovation as a biblical way of thinking, it's no longer just, do we change or not? You see, so many of the fights in education generally, and in culture and theological education, are between traditionalists who don't want to change anything because they think it was inscribed in the book of Leviticus rather than usually about 22 years ago, and progressives who want to change everything and say the curriculum is hopeless and we just got to throw it all out and start over from scratch and we're no longer going to teach fill in the blank. Rather than saying, how do we hold these together in creative tension and find the best paths forward? Concrete example of this in theological educationalism. For me, I stumbled into it in 2008. Fall of 2008, the economy crashes. Most of the institutions, when you looked at your likely payout from endowment and your budget projections, you know, the rosy scenario was a really challenging ski run. The really doomsday scenario was an Acapulco cliff dive. And the realistic assessment was, you know, like something you wouldn't want to try unless you were ready to die. And I was thinking, what are we going to do? And it looked like people were going to lose jobs and people were going to get into fights. It was just going to be a survival mode. And Darwinism was like survival of the fittest, and I wasn't all that fit. So it was, you know, pretty anxiety-inducing. And then I came across a contrast of phrases from James Surowiecki, who said, you know, too many people think about sinking the ship in crises. Rather, they should worry about whether they're missing the boat. Just a shift of metaphor, and I thought, oh, well, that sounds like an adventure if you're trying to get on a boat. And then he gave some examples how Chrysler started in 1932 in the midst of the Depression, that the iPhone, or the iPod, was actually developed at the time of the dot-com crash in 2001. Duke Chapel at Duke's campus, the cornerstone is 1930. You begin to realize, and then I thought, well, there have been other times when a crisis might have led to an opportunity. Well, what I had to do is actually engage in storytelling, something institutions don't do very much. We usually do it for the sake of an anniversary, and then it's hagiography, humble beginnings to the glory days now. Or if you're really angry at the contemporary president or dean or whomever or denomination, it's a Jeremiah from glorious beginnings to the current decline, but not the nuanced kind of storytelling. Where I began to discover that at Duke, there was a regular pattern of about every 10 to 15 years, a process of pruning and starting something new in response to what seemed to be an unstable environment and a particular economic challenge. And that's where we have to be moving ourselves toward, is that kind of creativity that looks at one's institutional history and their vocation and finds what's the most life-giving character of what's brought us to the present. And now, how do we not just keep repeating that because we know how to do it, how do we respond to those forces and those challenges and those opportunities that are out there in the environment and lean into them, guided by the end, in ways that enable that creative innovation? It's about having an entrepreneurial mindset that begins to look for the opportunities rather than trying to imagine a not so glorious present, much less a nostalgic, false sense of the past. It's about holding all those things together. You see, theological education, 25, I told the deans at Baylor that I was confident of two things. The first was that none of the schools of the university would look very similar to what they look like now in 2050. None of them. I was absolutely sure of that. The second thing I was confident of was that I had no idea what they would actually look like. They didn't find either comment very reassuring. But it means that what we need to be doing is that kind of improvisation. You ever hang out with people like, was it the Calvin Institute for Christian Worship? And John Winfleet, in a rash moment, asked if I wanted to do my presentation with a jazz combo. And I said, great. I don't know why I said that. I met him 20 minutes before we went on stage. And then I found out that they didn't know each other either. And it was like sheer terror. Like, they didn't know me, I didn't know them, they didn't know each other. We had a few minutes to say, you guys know Autumn Leaves? Yep. You all right doing that in a couple of different styles? Yep. How about I go 20 minutes and then you go a while and then I'll come back? And this was in front of 1,200 people. It was sheer terror. It was also the most magical hour I've spent in a very long time. Because if you've got the traditioning and you've got the shared practices, then you can lean into an uncertain present and future because you have the confidence and the trust in what might be possible. We may not know what's 25 years out or 35 years out. We do know who's still going to be guiding the future 25 or 35 years out. Machine learning, artificial intelligence, huge challenges. The church needs to be the place that is the source of innovation and entrepreneurship, that gathers people together, that helps spur and stir the kinds of innovation that was a hallmark of the early church in the second century, what Calvin wrote calls Christianity's surprise. It was hospitals and education and all kinds of other institutions and businesses that were spawned out of that sense of a confident trust in the future and the creativity that comes from people from all sorts of different sectors. Israel is known as the country that's the hotbed of innovation. You know why? Compulsory military service. It drives people who wouldn't otherwise hang out together into the same environment, and it becomes like an incubator. Well, that's what the Church of Jesus Christ ought to be. The kind of place where people are gathering together who are engineers and artists and school teachers and social workers and homemakers and all the bewildering variety of ways of imagining the world coming together as the church. But we need theological education to be engaged in the conversations, the imagination, the learning kinds of environments. We need theological education to look a lot more like Stanford's D School than what ATS currently expects. Because it's not about just forming people for the church of 1970. It's about leaning into a purposeful focus that enables us to draw the best of the past into the present in a way that the future keeps coming back and we can generate the really transformational innovation. It's what will bring institutions to life. Maybe in radical ways through pruning and maybe even dying, but you know, there's even some stuff about dying and rebirth somewhere. It's either in Shakespeare or the Bible. Something about a seed that you bury and the wheat springs something. I mean, there are these faint memories we have of stories that ought to be shaping how we think about organizations and what it means to bear witness in the 21st century. They could provide huge opportunities. Two quick stories, and then one. One, I was asked by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, he's now retired, Martin Dempsey was his name. He actually has a master's degree from Duke in Shakespeare studies, go figure. He and I are both senior fellows at the Coach K Center on Leadership and Ethics at the Business School, so we kind of know each other. And he was coming down for one of our roundtable discussions, and he said, could you read a book I want to talk to you about? The book was called Humans Are Underrated. I thought, that's a weird book for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to be reading. I would have thought it was, you know, Future Bombs or Syria or something. And so I'm reading the book, and it's the first part of it's just this bewildering thing about machine learning and how it's displacing all sorts of jobs and how the nature of work is undergoing dramatic transformation. And this is where I learned about how many fewer lawyers you need, because you don't need to do the same kind of case research. You just press a button and you've got what 500 paralegals used to do over the course of 6 months. It's happening in medicine with Watson Health and all these sorts of things. So you're reading all this. And then the writer says, but there are three things that the machines won't ever displace human beings. The first is empathy. The second is teamwork. And the third is storytelling. Dempsey thought this was really crucial to the shaping of future leaders in the military and how they engage in understanding conflict. I immediately thought, oh my goodness, what is the one thing that universities are terrible at? Actually, not one thing, three things. Empathy, teamwork, storytelling. And then I thought, what's the lifeblood of the church? This ought to be our moment. We ought to be seizing that. And yet it doesn't appear anywhere in the book. It wasn't anywhere on Marty's mind that that might be a context, an opportunity. If we seize, if we recover. The church, before the MDiv, actually had much better ways of forming people in empathy, cultivating teamwork, understanding storytelling. We need to recover those sorts of practices. The other story is just an image about tradition and innovation that comes from one of my heroines, a woman named Maggie Baron-Keatson. It's actually even become a more interesting and complicated story than the one I told in the little Christian social innovation. Maggie was in Burundi when the civil war happened, and she was tied up in a chair, stripped naked, tied up in a chair, made to watch as 70 members of her family were killed in a massacre by the militia. Her best friend decided to die with her husband and asked Maggie if she'd take care of her, raise her two children. And then the militia, just an act of added cruelty, handed her the beheaded head of her best friend. Maggie decided she wasn't going to let hate have the last word, so she found children that her mother had adopted. Maggie's never married. She has no children. She found the adopted children that her mother had hiding in the sacristy of the church. She said, we're going to rebuild this village. She found all the money she could around the church and the village, and she went and bought 25 more kids freedom from the militia. So now she has 34 kids. She said, we're going to rebuild this village. She became this unbelievable social entrepreneur. She created an agriculture area for food. She established a school where the older kids could teach the younger kids. She did microfinance. She did job training. She built a swimming pool over the site of the massacre because she said she wanted the children to have their vision cleansed like the waters of baptism by swimming together. She built a mortuary next to her house in the center of the village because she said, unless we teach people how to care for those who've died, they won't know what it means to live. When you ask her why she did all this, she says, love made me an inventor. It's a wonderful phrase to capture the heart of traditioned innovation, right? Because it's not Hallmark love or Valentine's love. It's the story of God's love from creation to new creation. And when you live in that story and you're guided by that vision of the reign of God, it inspires that kind of creativity that sees a swimming pool as an opportunity for a new way of experiencing baptism. A more as a way of discovering what new life is all about. I say it's a more complicated story because over the course of the last 20 years, she had educated and formed around 30,000 kids in the village of Maison Shalom and its satellite practices. Unbelievable, she started a medical school. She was employing 400 of her graduates in her workforce as she was doing all of this work. She's now in exile again because she was too much of a threat to the current president of Burundi, someone who 5 years ago had declared her the mother of the country, but then discovered she was just a little too much of a mother for too many people. And so he sent death threats, and she had to flee in the trunk of a car, now living in Kigali, Rwanda. I saw her a few weeks ago again. And I asked her about what she was up to. She said, well, you know, it's kind of like the Joseph story. I said, excuse me? She said, you know, sometimes you go into exile and it's very hard to find the hand of God. She said, but you just got to keep knowing that God's hand is in the story. And you just got to stay focused on the future because you can't stop God's love. I was tired. It was the end of the semester. And I was feeling like I could stop God's love. And here she is in exile. But remember, she's situated within this vision of the story of Scripture that comes to life. So even though now she's having to reinterpret that life in the midst of a new bewilderment, it's still the source of hope. She came to Duke 3 years ago because we gave her an honorary degree. Our president had said that he wanted to honor not just famous people, but people that students should admire. And so a group of us nominated her, and lo and behold, he selected her. And so she came and was there for 4 days. I was privileged to be her faculty sponsor, so I got to host her for 4 days. I say she's privileged, but it was actually miserable. Because, you know, if you're around wretches, you feel pretty good about your life, but when you're around somebody like her, I was just like so aware of my smallness and pettiness. And so one day I just said to her, I said, Maggie, I said, could you tell me, you know, I know from you talking about life in Burundi, she has a chapel that she'd pray every day from 5 to 6. It was just her and God. I said, could you tell me what you do? She said, well, mostly I just listen to God. I thought, oh, there's that intimacy thing. She could tell I was frustrated because I was wanting some techniques that might help reform my prayer life or improve it. So I just sit there. She said, well, there is one prayer I say every morning. I said, oh? She said, yeah. She said, but I don't know how it would sound in English. And I said, well, could you try it in English? Because your English is better than my Kirundi or French. And she said, huh. We're driving the car, just kind of silent. And she said, it goes something like this. Lord, let your miracles break forth every day. And let me not be an obstacle in any way. I said, Maggie, that's pretty good in English. And there's a reason why she's such an artistic and powerful practitioner of tradition. Because she believes God's miracles still do break forth every day. And, though of all the people I've gotten to know over the course of my life, who are potential obstacles to God's purposes breaking forth and God's miracles breaking forth, Maggie's at the very bottom. And part of the reason is because she prays that prayer to not be an obstacle. My hope and prayer for us, in our settings of theological education, in the conversations here, is that we would believe that even in the midst of the bewilderments, God's miracles will continue to break forth every day. And that we and our colleagues would not be obstacles in any way, but would lean into both our past, the life-giving traditions, in ways that would enable us not just to meet the challenges, but to get ahead of them as we bear witness to the Spirit who's making all things new. Thanks.